International Week of Remembrance of the Victims of the Holocaust. More than 50 years have passed since the Nazi genocide, and we say never again. Yet, on a regular basis, our newspapers and televisions expose current instances of atrocity and brutality. Hatred of people because of their race, ethnicity, or religious belief continues to exist in our world, stripping all of us, whether we are victims, perpetrators, or observers of our humanity. Since 1979, the Concord-Carlisle Human Rights Council mission, dedicated to social justice and religious understanding, has challenged the people of Concord and Carlisle to recognize our own prejudices, to learn from them, so that we can choose to let them go, never to forget the terrible consequences of hate. An important goal of our celebration this evening is for us to acknowledge that these terrors will not be eliminated unless we all seek solutions to injustice present amongst us and elsewhere in the world. I invite you to listen to our honored guests whose lives were changed through cruelty and hatred. Let us reflect on how we, residents of this American town, with its long history of seeking truth and justice, can create in our community the climate for freedom that is the model for the Human Rights Council's purpose. Welcome.
Thank you, Ruth. I'm Chris Deacon. I'm the current chair of the Human Rights Council. And I want to thank you for coming in from such a beautiful day before it's really over to join us this evening. Without any further ado, I would like to welcome back again Ms. Rosalind Garrett. Denmark, 1943.
Miss Weizmann and Hitler are turning the screws. The fear, they say, grows in paper. How could it be Denmark's Jews to walk free after 3 years of kind occupation? We will take them like sheep in their beds as they sleep on the second night of their new year. Gavazzi at home. They'll be helpless alone. When they cry out, no one will be. The Germans, they'll head off the Danes. My friends, such a dangerous move. In 3 hours, the transport ship will
I want to take a moment just to point out some of the maybe non-obvious features of the evening. We have incredible artwork here done by eighth graders. You won't believe they're eighth graders when you come up here and look at it closely. I just want you to know. It's really wonderful. We also have some poetry and stories written by students that are displayed out on the table in the hall. We have a limited number of copies, but some of you can take them. I just want to make sure that you know that they're there so you can look at them. And we have a special treat. We have a great student from Sanborn here this evening to read us one of her poems. This is Louisa Slocum.
My poem is called, What Can I Do? I hear the cries for help outside my window, but what can I do? I'm just one individual, so what can I do? I hear the train rattle by my house late at night, but what can I do? I'm just a peasant, so what can I do? I smell the horror of human flesh smoldering, but what can I do? I'm just a young woman, so what can I do? I see my friends reaching out to help, but what can I do? I am not them, so what can I do? I read about the 6 million killed, but what could I have done? I was not a German, so what could I have done? I hear the accusations and the anger, and I ask, why didn't I do anything? Individuals can change the world, so why didn't I do anything?
Wonderful. I actually had been thinking about things I wanted to say as a way of introducing our speaker, and you basically said it. I've been thinking about how hatred and acts of hatred don't only affect the hated. They affect the whole world. And you said it. So I'm really delighted now to introduce our speaker. This is Elizabeth Dopazzo, and I'm going to let her tell you about herself.
Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me here tonight, and so many people on a Sunday night. I didn't expect that. I was here far too early, and I saw three or four coming in. I thought, maybe there'll be 10 or so, you know. So I'm really surprised. I want to just give you a little glimpse of how life was in Germany at that time tonight from a different perspective. Actually, I feel more comfortable with teenagers, but I see quite a few of them here, so I'll kind of look at them. I feel like I'm in a classroom. Of course, we have to go back many years now. I don't know how aware you are, where you're coming from, other than Concord here. There are over 100 books written by revisionists that claim that it never happened. And people exaggerate, and people died in the war, and that's the way it is in war. But you know what? Unless you're informed, you could read those books and actually start having doubts yourself, because they are very convincingly written. So the more we know, and the more we tune into that time and make ourselves aware of what really happened, the better it is. Because actually, the stereotypical German is very meticulous in keeping records. And the Nazis practically condemned themselves by having kept all those records. And now one can go to Berlin and find records that were, until the wall came down, were not available to people. So now we find out even more than what we knew before. So it did happen, and Germany has to live with that history whether they like it or not. And it's very difficult for young people today, because they are also asking questions of their grandparents, what did you do, granddad, and so on. And there are even some families who are barely on speaking terms because of it. Now, let's go back to, let's see, 1928. Where's Joan Hilton, by the way? Joan? Ah, there you are. How much time do I have? That's always crucial. Oh, there's a clock here. Big clock, yes. How much time? 40 minutes, a short classroom period. Well, that's not so good. But I would encourage you, if you do have any questions, feel free at any time. We don't have to be so formal, you know, at the end, 10 minutes, now it's question and answer time. So raise your hand and ask questions at any point. It's fine with me. All right, now, 1928. Germany, by the way, is a beautiful country. I don't know how many of you have been to Germany. It's a beautiful country. It's very much like New England, like parts of New Hampshire, Vermont even. Of course, they don't have the Grand Canyon or anything like that, but it is a beautiful, scenic country. So in 1928, my mother met my father in Hamburg, which is a beautiful city, like Boston, and very much like Boston, actually. And they met at a convention, and my mother was 17, so he needed permission to get married. So she was madly in love, and she asked her parents, oh, can I get permission to get married? And they said, absolutely not, you're our youngest daughter, you're not going to get permission to get married, and he's too old for you. My father was 24. So what do you do then if you still want to go ahead with your plans? Well, you elope, of course, and that's what they did. And actually, my husband and I, we were hoping our daughter would do that. Go to Bermuda, perhaps, or Aruba, or someplace, and say, oh, calling us, we're married. Great, then we would have spared ourselves that elaborate wedding. But it was not to be. So, but it was nice. I'm all for small weddings and great marriages, actually. So they went to the eastern part of Germany. My mother actually was born in Lübeck, which is a beautiful old trading city near Hamburg. So they went to the eastern part, close to the Czechoslovakian border. My father had a business there, a barber shop. He spoke five languages fluently and corresponded with people from different parts of the world, which actually was a great detriment to him too later on when Hitler came around. Because the correspondence of foreign mail. So life was very pleasant. I was born first, 1929. Now we're only talking ancient history. Yes. So 1929, which actually was the year when you had a disaster here in this country, Great Depression, it's called. Well, of course, it comes from people being depressed. Very depressed, the Great Depression. And some people, even as I recall reading, jumped out of windows in New York. Oh dear, money's gone, that's it, life's all over, that's all, that's it. And that's, of course, if you're very materialistic. If you're not so materialistic, you might think, well, money's gone, I'm still here, I'm in good shape, I can do something, start life over again. Depends where you know, how you think about things, how you perceive things. So, in Germany also was a depression, but it depends during a depression where you live. If you live in the country or in the city, and if you lived in the country and you probably have a garden and some fruit trees and you know, because it gets really down to the bare essentials, like a roof over your head and something to eat. So it depends. We were not so much affected by the depression because my father was mostly paid in his barber shop, even though he wasn't there that much. He traveled a lot. He had a manager. Usually paid in kind rather than money. A little chicken, you know, from the farmer, and some vegetables, and a little sack of potatoes, something like that, and some eggs and so on. We didn't have a car. We had bicycles, and we had lovely toys. My brother was born a year after me. Germany was known for its toy industry and other things. In fact, the whole piece of history to me always seems like a huge puzzle. Now, if you've ever done a puzzle, you know, like maybe when your child will start with 24 pieces or something, then you go in advance to eventually 500 or even 1,000 or even more. And at the end, there are some pieces missing. You know how frustrating that is, don't you? Extremely frustrating. You look under the table and everywhere, those pieces now went to all that effort and now look at what happened. So this is like a puzzle, this history, because Germany was thought of as a country of culture, people, intelligent people for the most part, and Jews, I even hesitate to say it, because they were Germans. They had German citizenship, they were integrated into society, assimilated, perhaps better than in some other countries, including this, I might add. And so, now, how could that have happened? Why did so many people go along with such schemes? I mean, it's totally mind-boggling, it really is. So now, I don't know how much you know about, you know, I don't even like to talk about numbers. One's mind can barely conceive thousands, let alone millions of people that were done away with. It's very difficult. But if you take out a family or a person that might have been related to you, then it becomes really, then it's alive, you know. So that's what I like to do. I know, I have a friend, and her father's a doctor. Now, you think doctors have a little something up here. And we were talking, and he said, oh, I don't think it was 6 million, probably 5. They always exaggerate. You know, my hair almost stood on end. I said, excuse me? What are we talking about here, numbers? What does it matter if it's 6 million or 5 million? It was millions, that's a fact. Now, if you take out somebody that might have been your best friend or so, obviously not, but if it was, then it might take on a different dimension. Why do you say that? And you being a doctor, and you said, well, no. I mean, really? It infuriated me. We had a heated discussion that evening. Can you read that? So, now, Hitler, of course, didn't spring up overnight. I mean, he was around, you know, and had followers, but we never saw him. People had radios, because there was no television in those days. And people were saying, a lot of people in Germany, who is this guy? Where did he come from? Is he foreign? He's not German. Now, where did he come from? Do you know, I go to colleges, too, and lately, I don't know why, rather prestigious colleges. I'm not going to mention which one. And they say, didn't he come from Australia? Well, of course, what I would like to say then is, what, are you stupid or something? How did you get into this college? But anyway, I restrain myself, believe me. So I usually say, don't you mean Austria? Oh, yes, I meant Austria. So he came from Austria. And over 90% in Austria are of this religion that he was part of. He was a Catholic. He was a Roman Catholic. No getting away from that. Nevertheless, he did not push for religion in general. He wanted actually to do away with it. But nevertheless, he used whatever he could to get where he finally ended up. And if he had an audience like you in front of him and he found out ahead of time, well, they're mostly Catholic, oh, good. Then he would say, he was shrewd and cunning. And he would say then, Christianity is the basis for our belief and may God bless our efforts. And people would think, oh, that sounds good. That sounds very good. And then I have this picture here. Now, well, one's a copy, actually. I don't know what strikes you about this, and you think of other dictators. You see, other dictators like Mussolini or military dictators in some countries. And then you see this picture of Hitler. I wonder if you can figure out what is striking about this. You don't have to tell me, and I'll just tell you if you like. But if you're thinking, you think you know, raise your hand. What do you think is striking about him? It's very plain, isn't it? He's very simple. He presents himself very simply. Well, of course, he never made it past corporal in the First World War. Nevertheless, there are most dictators, they have medals here, and they practically weigh them down on the left-hand side. And they, you know, strutting their stuff with the medals and everything. He didn't do that. He had the Iron Cross from the First World War, and he basically says, I'm one of you. I'm a simple guy, I'm one of you, and I want to make Germany great again. And to young people, he would say, you are the ones, you're going to make Germany great, and if you're physically and mentally fit, you'll be the rulers of the world eventually. So that's how it was. We didn't see him, but of course he talked plenty on the radio. And a lot of people, especially in northern Germany, Germany is basically divided religious-wise, if you could say it that way. Catholics in the south for the most part, in the northern part mostly Protestants or Lutherans. To this day, actually. Of course there are others mingled in, of course. But there are very few other religions in Germany. Now there are more, but at that time it was basically Protestant and Catholic. And of course Jewish people who had synagogues in most cities in Germany. And now when Hitler took over in 1933, things began to change. But not like many people think, oh, Hitler had power now, and things went downhill, Jews ended up in concentration camps, and so on and so on. It wasn't like that at all. It was step by step by step, and one step was a little worse than the step before. And when do you actually do something? Do you wait till it gets worse? Or do you think, like some Jewish people, because they were, as I say, I can't emphasize it enough, they were Germans, and many of them, I'm translating hundreds of letters right now from a Jewish family, rather large family, Germans, and they were waiting until 1938. But then the letters get a little more desperate, towards 1939 especially. But in the beginning, oh, let's wait this out. We've always lived here, and they're not going to do anything to us. And one was a doctor, and he said, I'm a doctor. They're not going to do anything to me. I even treat people if they don't have any money. And what are they going to do? And perhaps, you know, perhaps somebody will kill the lunatic, and maybe things will change, or maybe he'll do something stupid while Hindenburg was still alive, and he'll get rid of him, or something will happen. Why don't we kind of keep a low profile and kind of, you know, don't make any waves, and then maybe it'll be all right. Now, as far as our family, my father belonged to a group of people, they called themselves International Bible Students. And they were a minority, there were no more than about 20,000. But later they changed their name. And you have heard of them under a different name, Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, can you figure out, or do you know why Hitler hated them so? That's what I'm getting at. You'd have to know a little bit about them in order to know why Hitler hated them so. He hated them so much that during the war, according to an eyewitness account, he said, these people will be exterminated along with Jews. Now, why did he hate them so much? That's my question. An eighth grader said the other day, oh, I know, because they're so annoying on a Saturday morning. Yes, I said, maybe, you know, your parents on a Saturday, they want to sleep longer, and here they come knocking on the door. Oh, God, here are these people again. Why don't they just, you know, go? And another one said, I know why. Because they used to wake up Hitler on a Sunday morning with that watchtower and the awake and the Bible. And I said, well, that would have done, that would do it, wouldn't it? Do you think they even got to his house, his eagle's nest he had in the mountains? I don't think so. I mean, and very quickly after Hitler had power, he established the Gestapo, the SS, and the SA, and I mean, I have some pictures here. My uncle was a photographer, and when you see those pictures, I mean, it was very intimidating to see some of these goons walking down the street in marching. Very intimidating. Unless you were Nazi, of course, and you were there and shouting, you know, Heil Hitler. Eighth grader asked me the other day, why did people always say Hi Hitler in Germany? And I'm very glad when people speak up. I said, Hi, what do you mean? And he said, well, I always see pictures of him saying, of people saying, Hi, Hi Hitler. I said, no, it wasn't like that. It was Heil. That comes from the Roman times. He got the idea from Hail Caesar, you see. So it's always nice because children are really great. That's why I like, you know, kids, because they're so honest and open. They say whatever they think, and then you can talk about it, you know. So in any case, my father was arrested in 1934. Hitler hated them because they, first of all, would not say Heil Hitler. And they pledged allegiance already, or even to this day, they pledge allegiance to God rather than governments. And of course, if you're thinking that you're an international brotherhood, you're not going to take up arms against your brothers, even if your government tells you to. That could be maybe your friends. That could be your friends. And they're practically related to you. And it also eliminates prejudice. We were brought up to think that basically, we're brothers and sisters because Adam and Eve had the different genes in them in Genesis, the story, and then they spread out, different races came about, different cultures, and God chose a people to represent him. A lot of people don't even know that Jesus, if you think of him as a savior or as a historical figure, that he was Jewish. A lot of people don't know that. So, when he was arrested by the local police, who were also his customers in the barbershop, they would say to him, why don't you give up this religion now? Just keep a low profile, don't do anything, blend into the woodwork, so to speak. You could do that in Germany, and those people now are called bystanders. You could be a bystander in Germany. I don't know anything, I don't know, it's not my issue, I don't bother me, you know, like that. Plus, I must say, there were not as many Jews in Germany as people might think. There were less than a million out of a country of 60 to 70 million people. So not everyone even knew a Jew. We only knew two during that time. Two. One was my teacher, and one was a neighbor. And you know, this is why I think it's like a puzzle. Even the wives of some of the Nazis in our neighborhood would take food, clothes, and offer companionship. Come out, you know, we'll be there for you. Much later, my mother remarried, and my sister is named after her, Hannah. Hannah, lovely name. When I hear Hannah, I like it. Well, so my father was arrested, sent to prison, but he came back. The letters I'm translating now, the patriarch of this Jewish family, he was in Dachau twice. Twice he was able to come out through the intervention of a German business partner, and the second time through the intervention of a British nobleman that he knew also in as far as business. So it wasn't always in the beginning gloom and doom. Auschwitz and Treblinka, Sobibor, all those places, that was much later, and also it was in Poland, far away from Germany. Even though on German soil all these things happened also, not to say that. So, and when you mentioned in your song, I listened to all the words about Denmark. Yes, Denmark has a much better record for helping their Jews. And you know what? That even some German soldiers helped to get the Jews on the boats to for Sweden. Not maybe because they liked Jews, but they wanted to get back at the SS. It wasn't all like, you know,
the army and the SS, they were all buddies, and it was not like that. The SS was the so-called elite, and they were used for the most part later on in concentration camps as guards, because they had sworn a loyalty oath until death to Hitler personally. But many in the German army, soldiers, were not Nazis. I don't know if you're aware of that. It was not one giant Nazi army. There were many soldiers who were not Nazis, but you basically had two choices in Germany. There was no such thing as, well, you could say I'm a conscientious objector, like my father. But then you had to pay the price. My father and all his friends paid the price. So during 1934 and 1938, my father was in various prisons. And one of the prisons was near our house. And when we were quite small, of course, my mother would always send us out practically every day with food. And when the prisoners would walk past our house to their construction site, we would hide behind trees because it was absolutely out of the question to let the guards see you. You weren't allowed to even just smile or do anything with the prisoners or talk to them. So we would give them the food. And I had a letter 60 years later, a few months ago, from a teacher in that part of Germany, saying that her husband always wished he could have met that little boy and girl who used to bring food. So, in other words, whatever good deeds you do in life, it's never forgotten or lost, even if you don't get to know it like I did. But I would encourage everyone not to be a bystander in any circumstances. Look for opportunities to do good deeds, and especially teenagers, because they're not always so happy. It's for many a miserable time. And if you do good things for other people, that's what we were always taught, my brother and I, when we were little, then it comes back to you. That's the only thing that's going to make you really happy, if you do things for others. And it comes back to you tenfold. Maybe not from the people you do it to, but in other ways. So, 1938. We knew many farmers. My father used to go and study Bible with different people and so on. We had many friends. And then in 1938, one morning, the Gestapo came. Now, up to that time, of course, Jews were told in Germany, get out, we don't want you here, Jews are our downfall and all that. And signs up in cities especially, Jews get out, and above their shop windows and so on. Now, where were they supposed to go? I'd like to ask you now as an audience, where do you think they could have gone? Why didn't they go there? Now, most German Jews were not poverty stricken. There were no ghettos in Germany. I'm not saying they were all rich, but they were fairly affluent, middle class, most of them. So now you have some money, and let's get out of here. We're not wanted here. So where are you going to go then? Do you think you can go somewhere and say, I want a ticket to somewhere? There's no such place. You have to have a definite destination. And you've got to have all kinds of papers. And you've got to go to the German police to get your good conduct, your citizen good conduct papers. Now, as a Jewish person, you don't want to be seen in the police station. But that's where you have to go. Now, where are you going to go? Tell me some countries where they could have gone. And why didn't they? I'd like to hear that from you. Yeah, well, you see that? Excuse me?
South.
Yes, South America. Many went there. Many went there, that's very true. Nevertheless, when you're in Germany and you have no connections to South America, you know, that's it then, I'm going to get a ticket here to go to South America. It's not that simple. That's what people don't realize, you see. But you're right, many went there. Now, come up with some countries where they could have gone. Yes. Sweden. Yes, as you heard in that song even, many were able to go to Sweden. Sweden has a somewhat better record, that's true. But now some other countries. Where? Ah, they were supposed to go there actually. But you know what? It was a British protectorate and they didn't really want them there. If you've ever seen that movie Exodus, you'll see that they didn't even want them after the war. It's all a very shameful piece of history all around. Why don't you mention your own country? You have that Statue of Liberty here that says, what does it say? Send me all your miserable people or something. you know? I mean, so why couldn't they have come here? Why? Do you know why? You almost didn't make it then. You're lucky to be sitting here. And I'm very glad to see you here. But, you know, that is very true. It was a tiresome, long process. And then your government here hid behind a quota system. Oh, we can't take any more. We can take other refugees, but no, there's too many of them here that are coming. What about that ship of children that went on the coast of Florida, was sent back to Germany, to Hamburg, no less? I mean, it's a shameful piece of history. Canada, worse. In 12 years, they only took 5,000. No doubt the 5,000 are grateful. But what I'm saying is one of their parliamentarians in Ottawa was asked, how many can we take? You know what he said? There's a book with that title. None are too many. Okay? So, what about England? Oh, yes, now there's a country. Why didn't they go to England? Well, because the same thing is here. They were not wanted in England. I went to England after the war. Do you know that Jews were not allowed to join tennis clubs, private clubs, cricket clubs? Well, who cares about cricket? It's so boring. But anyway, they were not allowed to go in those clubs. You see? Oh dear, yes. When I went there first, I couldn't speak English. Oh yes, yes. Where do you come from? Oh, I used to cringe because it was after the war, and I thought, oh no, no, I'm German. I kind of tried to minimize it, you know. And I said, well, I was born in Germany. Oh yes, how fascinating, yes. So of course, then we still didn't know what they meant or anything. I thought, well, let's go beyond that. Maybe they find it fascinating, good. So go past that now, but. Anyway, so now we're going back to 1938. So it was very difficult for people to get out. They had to have affidavits and all kinds of papers, you know. It was not easy. Right. So the Gestapo came. Usually they came very early in the morning or very late at night. Now you might wonder why. The element of surprise, your home, catch you, you know, and they always came quick. And up to that time, my father had been arrested by the local police. But now when the Gestapo came, there were two of them, and one of them had a small, tiny, little handgun. He whipped it out of his coat somehow. We were sitting having breakfast in the corner of the kitchen, and he said to my father, one word, one word. Of course, by this time, there's no more free press and all that. Raus! Now, if you had a survivor here in your audience, they would cringe, and it would give them shivers down their spine just to hear that. And German, unfortunately, is also a language that lends itself to this harshness because it's so guttural, you know. And at least that's what I think. And so they said, raus, and there was a black van waiting outside, and no goodbye, hug, or anything. Out. My father went with in a black van, and that was it. I never saw him again. He was executed in 1940, and his friends with him. And one of his friends was beheaded. Now, they didn't do that too often, but occasionally to use people as a deterrent for others who refused the military draft. My father could have come out. One of my uncles, he was married to my father's sister, was in the SS. And my aunt used to say, get my brother out of there concentrating camp, do something. Well, he personally went to Sachsenhausen concentration camp just outside Berlin. And the commandant called my father in and said, oh, this prisoner here, he has a privilege. You know what that privilege was? They allowed him to shave the SS guards. Now, you might wonder why. Kids usually say, well, he was a barb. That's true, but there was more to it. They knew that when my father had the opportunity to slit their throat, he would not do it. And so the commandant said, here, and he thrust a piece of paper, my uncle told us this when he came back, thrust a piece of paper and said, here, sign this.
And my father said, I've seen this before. I cannot sign this, and I will not sign it. To give up his religion and go along with the Third Reich and all it stands for. Jehovah's Witnesses did have that opportunity, if you want to call it that. So he refused, and 14 days later he was executed. My uncle came back without him. We didn't even know that he had been executed until we had the Gestapo papers that we have now, confirming it. They sent us a probably standard telegram saying he died of heart failure. He was 35 years old. And so when my uncle came back without him, we said, I could keep an eye on that time here, 10, 20, 25 minutes, yeah. All right. That's another stereotypical thing in Germany. Punctuality is most essential in life. Oh, really? Yes. So I'm always too early wherever I go, of course. Yeah. You see that? It's sort of ingrained in you. You can't help yourself. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? You see, we're not supposed to stereotype people. I have a hard time with that. Because there are certain things that fit, you know, a few here and there. Well, in any case. So my mother was arrested the same day. The local police came and they said, what are you going to do with your children? So my mother said, I want them to go to my parents. And they said, we will take you. And they took us with a police escort. We had to leave our house, everything in it, everything there, only a small suitcase. And you know what we took? You might think about it when you go home tonight, what you might take. Not what they. Make everything personal. What would I take? What's important to you? We took our photo albums so that we would remember people. And we only saw a few of them again, so it's very valuable that we have the photos, and I do have them. And so we left with a police escort, and you know what? I didn't find out till, oh, when was it? Last year sometime, that the, also from the Gestapo files now, and a teacher sent me the files because he went to, he went with his wife to Berlin to look up about his family and came across my family's files and sent them. And it said in there, grandparents in Lübeck deemed unsuitable to bring up children, Nazi foster parents recommended. Now, I mean, I was so shocked. But here's the thing. It was a good thing we didn't have computers and stuff like that in those days. And everybody a telephone and so on, because the bureaucracy didn't catch up. And we went to my grandparents, and then it kind of died down, and we were very fortunate that we went to my grandparents. So my mother was taken back to the eastern part of Germany, and Saxony, that's the area, and was sent to prison for 3.5 years. She did see my father one time. They made eye contact in a courtroom. And they were sentenced one by one, and she did make eye contact. But then she didn't see him again. So she was 3.5 years in prison, and we were with my grandparents, and my grandmother was so outspoken. My grandfather used to say, oh, you get us all killed. You never keep quiet about anything. Everything's a big issue here. And my grandmother said, look, to us, when I get you into a school, you will not have any friends. You can't have friends. I didn't have a friend till I was 15 years old. So, because you might say the wrong thing, and don't say that we say at home that Hitler is, you know, Hitler is not all there, and he's an idiot, and he's a lunatic, and all that. Don't say that. Don't even say the war is going badly, because that's the treason, you know, talk like that. All right. So, we went to school. Well, in the first school, the principal wouldn't even have us. He said, get out of here. I don't want people like you in my school. So, we stood there, and so I don't remember this, but my grandmother said that I said at the time, well, next time we go to a school, tell them we are not religious. We don't even believe in God. We're just, you know, just people. And she said, listen, everything's documented. And they will find out, and it's even worse. No, we tell them who we are, and then we'll see. Well, finally, we were accepted in a small school. And I think to this day that the principal was a communist. The whole area was called Red, you know, like Red Concord. if that was the case, well, there might be a few floating around here, I don't know. So anyway, the thing was, I didn't like school. I didn't like school from beginning to end. I graduated, I have the diploma. Oh, here's the diploma. But I did not like school. It was very, extremely strict, and my teachers, I don't remember kindly. Only our home economics teacher, when she taught us how to knit socks and so on, stuff like that. But other than that, it was very, very tough. And Julia, since I know your name now, and your father and mother, I was so happy to see you when you came in here. Could you come here for a minute? Do you mind? Yeah, I was nervous too when I saw all these people, so, you know, come here, dear. This is the thing. Now, say Julia is me, and you're in the German classroom now, you see? And this is what was said to me, Julia, in front of the class, and to my brother, who felt even worse. He was enraged for years. He couldn't do anything good. And the teachers would say, how is it that you try to slide in here 3 minutes late? You thought I didn't notice? He tried to get out of saying hi, Hitler, is that it? Well, listen, explain to us why you were late. Why were you late? Why were you late?
My parents.
Oh, really? Oh, your parents are blaming that on your parents. I'm not interested in your parents. You are late 3 minutes and you're going to be punished for that. For each minute you're going to write 100 times, punctuality is most essential in life. Do you understand that? Do you understand that? Yes, of course you do. Now, of course, you have another option. You have another choice. You could put out your hands and I'll whack you with a heavy ruler on your knuckles. What do you want to do? You're right. Yes, I want you to bite tomorrow. You know that I don't want people like you in my classroom, but I'm stuck with you. You people are scum. You know that this father is in concentration camp. He doesn't have to be there. He's a coward. He doesn't want to fight for our country. Okay? And lately, the A students were in front in Germany, the last row, all losers, you know. So, now, lately you've been in the back too often. Unless you shake up in 1 week you're out of here. You might think, well, I don't like this school anyway. But the next one you're going to like even less, because I'm going to recommend you go to your school for the slightly retarded. I don't think you're all there. And you can tell that to your grandparents. You understand that? Yes, of course you do. Thank you, Julie. Do you feel a little bit humiliated? Well, of course you do. Very humiliating. And so, sit down. Yes.
That was
pretty
good on the spot, so sadly.
But, you know, it was like that, and we had to go through that, my brother and I. You know, sometimes kids, they get so enraged, you know, they say, well, why didn't he hit the teacher? Oh. There was one boy who hit the teacher one time. He got 3 years in juvenile detention, you see. And if you were really handicapped mentally, there was a big stigma in Germany. Hitler didn't want retarded people in the country. Many thousands were put away and put to death by injection. And then you got a telegram saying, unfortunately, your child died, you know, pneumonia or something. Probably another one of those standard telegrams. I had some notes here because I know we will use them for this here. I have to put my glasses on. You know, there are some things that you might, we think of Hitler as a, you know, like he wasn't even a human being, but he was. You know what, he was a vegetarian. Now, some of you might be vegetarians. And you know what? Love for animals was publicized through schools, lectures, etc. No dancing bears in Germany. You might think, dancing bears? Well, who's been in the wilderness here? Anybody? All right, did you see any bears? No, but who saw a bear in the wilderness at some point? All right, did you see them dancing? No, of course not. Unless they rub their backs against a tree, maybe they have some fleas or whatever. But the thing is, they don't dance. That doesn't come naturally. They have to be taught, and sometimes rather cruelly. I don't even like circuses where performing animals are. Now, if people want to jump around in a trapeze and all that, that's their problem. But I don't like to see trained animals. I don't. So, in other words, even though we could and do despise Hitler, but he had that love for animals. He hated Goering for hunting. He was a hunter. And he didn't like that. So isn't that something? And of course, no monkeys on leashes. Well, that means, you know, there were a lot of Italians in Germany at that time with the organ grinders. They had monkeys on leashes. Well, they had to flee for their lives back to Italy. And it was also to actually counteract rumors of brutalities that were done against human beings. But so that showed them, well, you see, Hitler, he loves animals, you know. Can't be that bad if a person loves animals. But is that always necessarily true? You see? See, that's the thing. My mother, when I was 15, remarried. Now, when your mother has a boyfriend and you're 15 years old, does not make your day, okay? Does not. And it could be somebody on a white horse coming riding along with a crown on top, and still you say, who is this guy? Get rid of him. Who is this? And we said that, my brother and I, who is this? How many languages does he speak? We tried to, you know, because my father was rather intellectual. So, and how many languages? Oh, only one. Well, there you are, he's ignorant. And, you know, I mean, and then after when the war ended, he said he was a communist. Oh, my God. And said he's a communist. Why, we used to say to him, why don't you go to Russia? They make you mayor of a big city or something. And get out of here, you know. But I'm so glad she married him because I have two lovely daughters. And I mean, sisters. And I have a lovely daughter, too. So, nephews and nieces and so on. But we did make my mother's life a little miserable. And you know, because of my stepfather, I almost couldn't come here. Government actually sometimes forces you to lie. Is this on record, on a tape here or something? Yeah, I hope it won't be held against me, but I've been here 35 years. So when we came, my husband from Spain, we went to Canada, we lived in Spain for a while. And then I said, well, since we're here now, why don't we go to the United States and, you know, have a look around. We didn't know a single soul in this entire country, and we came to Boston simply because my husband suggested California, and I said, well, that's another 3,000 miles. What if we don't like it? And there's too much sun. I know that from school, eighth grade even. You know, geology, and there's too much sun. Every day the sun shines, that's going to get on my nerves. And so... I've already been to California, and it proves to be true. I mean, it's a beautiful state, I'm not saying that. Florida, the same, and it's so humid and everything. And there are beautiful places in this country. Arizona, the Grand Canyon, you name it. It's a beautiful country. But here, I like it best, because it has the four seasons, and it's just a beautiful area, New England. Do you have a question?
Yes. How did you get reunited with your mother
and when? Ah, yes. Well, my mother was released from prison after her sentence was served, and she got a rather nice letter from the last warden in a prison and a gift. I'm sorry you have to leave, but I understand. School tomorrow. I might see you in class some other time. Bye-bye. No, there's no need for apologies here. That's fine. Good night. So what was that again? Oh, my mother. Yes, well, she came out of prison and she was given a very nice present by the last warden and a letter of recommendation which enabled her to get a job in a non-war related factory, making Easter eggs, mind you. Jehovah's Witnesses are not big on Easter eggs either, you know. No, neither Christmas, yeah, because, you know, different reasons.
But
oh, that was in 1941, late in 1941. And things were pretty bad then. The most fear we had at that time, my brother and I, that we would be killed by you all here, big American planes. No, wait a minute. Was America already then in the war? It was the British in the beginning. And they dropped incendiary bombs. And we lost our home the second time after my mother came out from prison. We had an apartment in the inner city in Lübeck. One night, Palm Sunday, mind you, the British bombed Lübeck, and we were at my grandmother's house. That's why we still have the photograph, and we never saw the place again. But material things, it's all. You're not going to say, oh, that couch, I love that couch. It's all irrelevant, isn't it? So we have our picture. And we were so afraid later when the Americans got into the war, the bombs got bigger, the planes were bigger. And I tell you, we spent so much time in school in the basement or in people's basement, even though we didn't like that, because when the water pipes burst and you have a direct hit, you can drown in your basement. All kinds of things can happen. And so, yes, we were reunited, but you know, life is not fair when you want to think about it that way. My mother died miserably of breast cancer and bone cancer and so on when she was 63 years old. So my brother was killed in Africa. It's a life, you know, one has to just keep going. And I know they would want me to do that and kind of keep my sense of humor in this life too. So let me tell you about the immigration papers. It says there, are you white? Are you black? Are you Oriental? You're Indian? What is this? I said to my husband, what? I thought they were all equal in America. Why do they have to know if we're black, white, or indifferent? He said, why do you always make an issue out of everything? All right. And then it said, were you ever a prostitute? So now, say for example, you were, one was, and then you write, yes. Well, of course, they don't let you into the country. Now they say, were you ever a communist? And have you ever had any connections to communists? I said, you know what? I never even liked my stepfather that much. And now, if I write yes, they won't let me into the country. I'm going to write no, that's it. And then later when they say, oh, I didn't know he was a communist. I have no interest in politics. So I'm going to try and get out of it that way. So bluff my way through, you know. So, if you have any questions, I don't want to overdo it because it's Sunday night and many of you, I'm sure, have to go to some type of job. Yes. Yes, and I was even in the Hitler Youth. I hate to tell you this, but since you asked, I should be totally honest. I was. 9 months I was in it, from 1944 to 1945, and I tell you the reason why. Because when the Gestapo came to our house several more times, and this one time when they came for my uncle, who was my mother's oldest brother, and he was in telecommunications, and he was supposed to have joined the Nazi party too. It wasn't one giant Nazi party. Teachers had their Nazi party, women's Nazi party, and all these different factions. So they pressured him, not only pressured, they threatened him, and he could be joined the next day. And now, at that time, they said, and your granddaughter is well past the age of joining the Hitler Youth. There'll be grave consequences, and whatever they said. I can't remember the exact words. So when they left, I said to my grandmother, that's it. I'm not going to end up where Papa was. You get me that uniform, I'll fake it. That's it. You know. And I joined. I'm really not happy to talk about it. But we were sent to Austria doing good deeds for the country, helping farmers and bring in the crops to put in the shortage of manpower. And as girls, we were taught how knitting and crocheting and all that stuff and everything. And the knitted things would go then to Russia for the soldiers. Of course, that didn't help either, you know. I mean, nothing helped. So, anyway, and so, but there I made my first friend. I had another girl that was also very nice, and there was a friend. And you know, there were many, how many, of course, I don't know, there are no statistics. Many boys were trained in a different way from girls, in a pre-military way, so that they were ready and obedient for army, navy, or whatever when the time came. All they had to do was change uniform. But girls differently. During Kristallnacht, 1938, there were also Hitler Youth boys, not girls, there's no record of that, that helped the other goons there, smashing Jewish windows and all that, the fanatics, you know. But there were also others in the Hitler Youth who joined because they wanted to get away when you're a teenager, think about it, from whom? Their parents, of course. And so they want to be with their peers, with their friends. Never mind Hitler. I mean, I want to be with my friends. If not, oh, anything wrong with you, something wrong with you, how come you're not in the Hitler Youth? I'm going to have a lot of fun getting away from those parents, you know, and so on. It was